American Voices with Senator Bill Bradley is made possible by Barrick Gold, America's largest gold producer and a force for good in the communities where we live and work.
For SiriusXM Radio, I'm Bill Bradley, host of American Voices. Each week on American Voices, we hear the stories Americans tell about their lives. But this week, we have a special presentation for you. TV director and producer Zane Busby. She's here to talk about the Survivor Mitzvah Project.
No one is remembering the people who, by some miracle, survived. There are still Holocaust survivors out there who need our help just as much as they did in 1939 when the world turned its back on them.
It's a compelling story you don't want to miss. I'm Bill Bradley. You're listening to an American Voices special, only on SiriusXM Radio. Zane Busby is a TV director and producer. She's directed shows like The Golden Girls and Newhart. She was discovered by Carl Reiner, co-starred opposite Jerry Lewis, but it was her trip to Eastern Europe, to Lithuania, to Belarus, to see her grandparents' homes that changed her life. It was there that she learned about Holocaust survivors who were penniless. They were struggling to pay for food, heat, medicine, shelter. Zane Busby eventually started the Survivor Mitzvah Project, which sends money to Holocaust survivors in need and personal letters so that they don't feel alone. Zane, welcome to American Voices.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be with you.
So tell me about your first trip when you learned that there were so many Holocaust survivors in need.
Well, my first trip was really just a kind of a vacation. You know, I had no idea this was going to change my life forever. And there was a professor in Lithuania who learned I was going to cross the border into Belarus. And he said, hey, here's a list of eight names. They're kind of on, you know, the back roads, the places where you're going to be searching for the homelands of your grandparents. And would you mind visiting them? They're very old. They have no visitors. They need a lot of things. And bring them some food and do this and that. So I did. And literally, it was like going back in time 200 years. I mean, there were crooked little houses. There were no cars. There were no restaurants. There were bullet holes on all the buildings. It was as if the war had happened yesterday. And it really made the period of the Holocaust seem very close because I was walking down the same streets and crossing the same rivers where thousands died and thousands, you know, hid. So I stopped at the first little hut. They all live in these little kind of log cabins. And I knocked on the door and there was no one home. And I went around back and there was a 92-year-old man, you know, on his hands and knees trying to dig out potatoes from the ground. It was already September, and the ground was going to freeze, and he needed his winter food supply. And I was with a guide and translator, and, you know, first we said shalom, because we didn't want to scare him, because these people have not had a very good history of strangers knocking on their doors. And he welcomed me in. We went into the hut, and we listened to his story. And this happened again and again and again. You know, I just kept seeing these old people, you know, desolate, you know, lonely, without any family, a lot of them, you know, some of them bedridden with no one to even look in on them. When I came back to the United States and went back on a soundstage into the world of comedy, I just couldn't get them out of my head. I just kept thinking, my goodness, it's, you know, it's November now. You know, what's going to happen to these people who had no windows and no food? And I just started sending them money. I didn't know how to communicate. I didn't know the language, so I would just draw a heart with a star in the center, wrap up some bills and send it off, thinking, well, it's okay if they don't know who I am. They just will know someone was out there and someone cared about them. And then the most amazing thing happened. I started to get letters back from these people, you know, little torn scraps of notebook paper and telling me, you know, what this meant to them just to be reached, not just the money, but just to know that someone out there cared. And it was just, you know, profound, absolutely profound. And it made me think that this was bigger than just these eight people, that there must be thousands of these people out there alone and lonely and desolate. So I started the Survivor Mitzvah Project to help them.
So tell us about the Survivor Mitzvah Project.
Well, what we are is a 501c3, and we are the only place in the world that's giving these people direct and continuous financial aid. And that's what they need right now, because these are people who, by some absolute miracle, survived the darkest days of human history. And they are just left twisting in the wind. You know, as we should, we remember the people who perished, and we have monuments, and we have museums, and we have remembrance days. But the thing is that no one is remembering the people who by some miracle survived. There are still Holocaust survivors out there who need our help just as much as they did in 1939 when the world turned its back on them. So this is really what we do. We reach out to these people, we help them get the food and the medicine and the comfort and the care that they deserve, and we also established letter writing so that we write to them all the time so that they can get a letter from America, which truly is as big a deal now as it was in 1910, you know. They reread them and reread them. They don't have families, so they don't have a community. They kind of live through our families. And we call this the family of strangers that we've created.
And so how many are there?
Well, we are now helping 2,000 survivors in 8 countries. But there are so many more out there. And we really literally do not have the funds to help everyone every month. So there are times when we have to play God, which is a terrible situation, and decide, is this person's heart medication more or less important than saving this person's eyesight? And I hate to be in that position. There are just so many more to help while there's still time, and there's still time to just do something about the Holocaust, because this is the last generation. We're going to witness this in our lifetime, the last generation of Holocaust survivors, and we are certainly the last generation who have the honor to be able to help them and say, when I found out about this situation, I did something about it.
So how do you confirm that they are survivors?
Well, we meet each one of them, and we vet them. We get their story. We get their history. We get their parents' name. There's pretty much no way that anyone who's Jewish who's still living there did not survive the Holocaust.
Right.
You know, in some way, whether they were, you know, in the camps. Most of the people, I would say 95% of the people that we help, they endured the Holocaust in the East, which is very rarely reported on. There's only a couple of books that just came out about it. We all know about the concentration camps, but there was so much more. In the East, there was something called Operation Barbarossa. And in 1941, the Germans fanned out into these groups called the Einsatzgruppe, which were mobile killing squads. And they roared into towns and villages on motorcycles and killed every man, woman, and child in their path, and then torched the village and moved on to the next one. So this was mass murder on an incredible scale. And these are the people who, by some miracle, survived that. They either, you know, crawled out of a pit under the bodies of their parents, or they ran, or they hid, or they swam across a river. I mean, the stories are just unbelievable.
So could you tell me, you refer to the survivors as the unluckiest generation?
Yes, 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 they certainly are. For the oldest of the people that we help, you know, they survived, you know, they were first of all born in 1905, 1906, 1911, you know, dates like this. They survived the Russian Revolution and World War I as children. Some of them fought in the Russian Revolution. You know, there was civil war, dislocation, evacuation, widespread violence. Then if they survived that, came the pogroms of the 1920s and the enforced famines of the 1930s when Stalin starved his own people. Thousands were murdered and hundreds of thousands came to the United States. If they survived that, came the rise of Nazism, then the full-blown Holocaust, where families were killed and more evacuations, homes were destroyed, starvation, ghetto, slave labor, you name it, more loss, more destruction. And if they survived that, after the war, they were caught behind the Iron Curtain, where, again, it was a crime to be Jewish, own a Yiddish book, speak their own language. A lot of them got sent to the gulag for 10 more years, if you can imagine this. And then if they survived that, came the Stalin's purges of the 1950s. And then Chernobyl came, radiation, cancers, death by the thousands, upheaval and relocation for the same people. And then Perestroika came, where the infrastructure of their countries collapsed and every penny saved was taken away from them when the banks failed, leaving them penniless and without any hope. So they truly are the unluckiest generation. Every decade was just a litany of upheaval and heartbreak.
You say, you know, you have one foot in comedy and one foot in the Holocaust.
Yes.
How do you avoid a disconnect between these two worlds? How they blend together?
Well, you know, I always just kind of walk the world with humor. And I even use humor with these people because, you know, when you meet these people for the first time, a lot of times, you know, they look their age or older. And after just sitting down with them, holding a hand, you know, they start to, like, lighten up. But if there's an old couple, I ask things like, was it love at first sight? And this is like a very bold question for a country where they don't even use the word love. Like in Russia, people don't say I love you the way we say I love you, you know. They don't use it like that. So, you know, that starts them, you know, laughing. And then from there on, it's an easy in to anything I want to ask. I'll tell you a funny story. I just used to sign my letters like, you know, with love and friendship, you know. And I didn't know at that time that love is not used the way we use love. We know we say love to everybody. I love you. I love you. We sign letters with love. So this 91-year-old man in Latvia writes a letter, and my translator turned to me and said, "What did you say to him?" And I said, "What do you mean?" The letter said, "To my dearest Zane, I can't believe that at my ripe old age, a woman like you would fall in love with me." And, you know, he thinks I'm, like, in love with him. So I call him my boyfriend, and I always, on Valentine's Day, which is when he was born, I send him a box of candy. But, you know, it's that type of thing. So we have kind of, like, they know that I'm going to come in with a smile on my face. I'm not going to be dour. You know, I'm going to visit with them and have a wonderful visit where we laugh.
Sure. Tell us some more stories where you're able to laugh with them.
Well, there was a great story in, I think it was 2012, I spent New Year's in the hut of a gentleman in Ukraine who, as an 18-year-old, you know, just an 18-year-old kid, was taken from his house and enlisted into the Russian army. They gave him a wooden gun because they didn't have guns, and they marched him off to fight the Battle of Stalingrad, right? So, and he was so amazing when he told his story because, you know, he endured an amazing battle. I mean, you know, where people like fought with bricks, you know, they threw everything. Women fought, kids fought. He fought this battle and he came home and he saw this woman at a train station. He didn't know what had happened to his family. And he said, "I could tell from her face that she was my sister." So I went over to her because it had been like 4 years. And I said something to her in Yiddish. And she started laughing. And that was my sister. And that's how I found her, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's you know, each one of these people holds the key to a history that we've never heard before. We made a couple of films, and one of them, Valerie Harper, reads a letter where she says that after the war, you know, liberation wasn't so sweet as people think, because it was the first time for most of these people to realize they were alone and everyone else had been killed. And they went back to their towns, which were just a bunch of broken rock and rubble, and they had to, like, you know, live in underground caves, and there were no old people, and there were no teachers, and there were no, you know, there was nothing, no photographs, no musical instruments. And she said the only thing she found was a torn picture of her grandparents. She says, "But I don't know anything about them. I don't know who they were. I don't know what they did. I don't know what they laughed over or for what or whom they cried over."
Hmm. Tell us about some of the correspondence you've had with them.
Well, the correspondence was amazing. The first letters that I got, I mean, I'll read you a little, because they were just tiny little short letters. And one woman wrote, she said, "I can't believe that someone in America would want to help me. I'm sitting here crying that total stranger is taking care of me. Thank you so much. Without you, I couldn't even buy an apple. But now I am not alone." And that's what just, like, struck me like a thunderbolt.
Yeah.
Another one wrote from Ukraine. She said, "We are all sick here, and I really don't know how to live further. I'm sorry for this letter. My writing is so bad, and I'm so very old. My mother and father were killed in Babi Yar." Now, Babi Yar was a mass execution of, like, 36,000 people in one, you know, day. She said, "It's so difficult, life. I sometimes think it would have been better if I had died with them. But then I got your letter. I am grateful to you over and over for your help, which for me means faith that there will be another day."
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And they write very, you know, the poetry is amazing. A woman said, you know, "If fields were pieces of paper and oceans were ink, I could never write to you all that happened to us."
That's great. You know, sometimes you don't realize that, and you're giving us all this. That's a tremendous service.
Yeah, and it's a pleasure because what these people teach you over and over again, you know, you expect them to be bitter, you expect them to hate everybody. You know, that's what I expected, at least. You know, how could you not? And again and again and again, I ask them now, especially as the years are going by and they're getting older and older, what's the most important thing in life? And to a person, they answer goodness, kindness, and compassion. do good deeds. Help someone if you can't help monetarily. Put a kind hand on the shoulder. Say a kind word. And if you can't do something good, just step out of the way.
That's incredible, given the life history.
I know. So there's a belief in goodness and kindness and a better world. And I asked the same gentleman that I was telling you about in Ukraine, the one who fought the Battle of Stalingrad. I said, well, you know, here you are living in Ukraine, which is very anti-Semitic. There's hostile, you know, Nazi marches up and down the streets. You don't know who your neighbors are. Do you hate the Ukrainians? You know, I just asked him. He said, no. He said, first of all, that's a nationalistic thing. He said, the problem with the world is nationalism. We all have no right to be proud of where we were born, what we look like, the color of our skin, or our religion, because none of us had anything to do with any of that. He said, but if you comport yourself like a decent human being, if you help people, if you're kind and compassionate, then your country and your religion and your race can be proud of you.
Before we get back to your story, I want to remind everyone you're listening to an American Voices special with TV director and producer Zane Busby. She's here to talk about the Survivor Mitzvah Project. Tell us your reaction to what you've heard from Zane today. Message me on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/American Voices with Senator Bill Bradley. So, Zane, are any of the people you talk to, do they ever express to you how they've come to terms with the fact of the Holocaust, with the fact of the Nazis, with the fact of this historical path that you've laid out of the unluckiest generation?
Well, you know, they, just like us, they cannot reconcile between good and evil. In other words, when you go there and you hear these stories and or you study the Holocaust or any genocide, really, you just can't believe that there are people where it's okay to saw a little girl in half, you know, by the hundreds, you know, where it's okay to torture people. You just like, I mean, I can't imagine that that's okay, you know, but there are people who think this is okay. So time and again, they've said things like these were not of a human mother born. Hmm. That was an expression I heard many times, you know, but they don't blame, you know, everyone. You know, they don't say, I hate all Germans or I hate all Ukrainians. Again, it's person by person, because there's a guy, if you want to hear another short letter.
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay, there's a wonderful guy named Isaac Bakhmeyev. He was raised half Tatar. His father was a Tatar and his mother was Jewish. So this young couple moved to another city and there they raised their children. And when Isaac was about 11, this is what happened to him. He says, I was born in 1929 into a family of five children, mother, father. When the fascists came on July 7th, 1941, my brothers and the boys from the neighborhood and I were just in the street playing ball. We heard soldiers shouting, so we ran home and told my parents. And then announcements started to be put up on the lamppost ordering the Jewish families to go to the town of Yatki. There were rumors that we would all be killed there. Our father gathered us and took us to a neighbor family. With tears in his eyes, he begged them for help to hide us, and they agreed. We stayed for 4 months in a barn cellar, and they helped us with whatever we could. My mother was pregnant at the time and gave birth to my brother there in the cellar. But my mother was afraid that it was very hard, both morally and financially, for that family to keep us, and decided that father should ask another family to hide us. So we moved our hiding place to a family we had been friendly with before the war. This family lived in poverty, but they shared with us every little piece of food they had. Very often we stayed hungry and we were cold and we were shivering from the thought that police and fascists might find out and that this kind family would suffer because of us. Now, my mother didn't have any milk to nurse the baby, so she made a doll out of cloth and put some crumbs of bread inside and let the baby suck on this. And with God's help, we somehow survived. I was blonde and blue-eyed, so I was often sent with my father or the family's son to go to the villages to beg for food. But sometimes the soldiers stopped us, accusing us of bringing food to the partisans, took the bread from us, beat us, and left with nothing. I carried a razor in my boot so that if I was captured, I could slit my own throat so as not to give away our hiding place. I was only 12 years old at the time. Humiliation, hunger, cold, this is what our family endured. While I am writing this, tears come to my eyes. May the warm sun always shine for you, Isaac.
That's a letter to keep.
Yeah, I mean, they're all, but this is what I'm saying, the archive that we're trying to get, you know, funding for, this archive is a miraculous archive of like 10,000 letters and hundreds of hours of videotape of this types of things. Mm-hmm. We just went with a 92-year-old woman who was one of the partisans as a teenager in Vilnius. The Avengers, it's called. She was part of a teenage partisan unit. You know, she went to the woods one day. She didn't know it would be forever because that same day everyone in the Vilnius ghetto was massacred and she never saw her family again. But she took us to the bunkers and she took us to where they hid and she took us to the forest. And this woman walked faster than I could walk. You know, the energy, the urgency to tell their stories. And finally, it's cathartic for them to know that their stories are being told after 70-something years.
So what do you think, I don't usually do this, but what do you think about what's happening in Ukraine now?
Well, it's really quite frightening. I got a lot of really frightening letters from people. You know, the Russians have always felt that the Ukrainians are beneath them, right? So there's always been this kind of like rift between it. Some of them say, you know, I'll get a gun, I'll defend my house if they come to my house. It's a terrible situation because what it really, really means is that prices went up again. So someone who's living, some of these people have like a pension, right? And the pension is maybe $60. But now that these countries are independent, the prices are Western. So you have to think, could you or I live on $60? No, right?
Right.
Not even close. You couldn't do anything for $60. You could buy one grocery shop and that's it. So there's still food and medicine and heat and shelter and all this stuff. So for them, the cost of heat went up like 70%. The food prices skyrocketed. So all it means for them is like it's worse and worse. The poverty gets worse and worse and worse. And the governments don't care. You know, everyone's waiting for these people to die. There's no social services. You have to understand that these people are aging in place with no Medicare, no health insurance, no old age homes, no assisted living, you know, no social security. So they're aging in place with nothing. And then when there's political upheaval, all it means is it gets worse because now they can't afford anything.
Mm. And you're referring here to all the elderly.
Yes, but the difference between the Jewish elderly and the other elderly is the Jewish elderly have no community left. So we're sure, there are poor people all over the world that should be helped. But if you're an elderly person in Ukraine, you probably have a family. You probably have a church group or a community or neighbors or this or that. When you're the last Jewish person in a town or village or one of the few left, right, and you don't have anybody, you also don't have a community. There's no one to reach out to. There's no synagogues. There's no schools. There's no aunts and uncles and cousins. There's just no lifeline left, you know?
That's just
so the only lifeline they have is us now, and I'm encouraging everybody to get involved because I really do believe that in this world that's so turbulent right now, if we don't stand up against genocide and intolerance, whether it be racial, religious, gender-based, we're in a sorry state. We have to start doing this. We're living in a world where they're burning people alive in cages. I mean, this is not good.
Right. You know, it occurs to me that you're doing God's work.
Thank you.
And it occurs to me that you've given so much to so many people. Yeah, earlier in the interview, you mentioned that today in Ukraine, there were fascist groups parading with anti-Semitic slogans.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I'll tell you, even worse is Lithuania, Latvia. In Lithuania, there are Nazi marches every year, and they have something which is their Halloween, which is the Jew parade, where people dress up in anti-Semitic, you know, horrible costumes and masks. And they march down the street with Nazis, you know, screaming, you know, with swastikas and German salutes and all this, you know, kill the Jews. And when someone went up to one of the, I think the mayor or something, they said, oh, it's fun for the children. This is the kind of stuff that's going on down the main streets. Now, at the same time in Lithuania, one of my older survivors wrote to me, it's like the clouds of war again in 1938. You know, it's frightening for them to see condoned police-escorted Nazi parades going down the streets where they're throwing eggs.
What about in Ukraine?
In Ukraine, too. In Kiev, there was a Nazi march, and there were plenty of them in Latvia. So it's not good. You know, it's not a good thing. There's a whole other uprising of anti-Semitism. And there's something else I just want to say about that. There was a a book recently written a couple of years ago called Erased. And what it means is that when these countries become newly independent, like Lithuania, Latvia, Ukraine, they search for a history to teach in school. So they want to come up with their own, say, Abe Lincoln, George Washington, something to wave the flag about, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they go back in their own history, and since they haven't, like Germany has, come clean with their own history, there's really nothing to write about, you know? So they have to make something up. Now, you have to also understand that some of the people who were the mass murderers, especially in Lithuania and Ukraine and elsewhere, also fought for independence, right? So they're considered national heroes. So Bandera in Ukraine, who, you know, was responsible for killing so many people, every park is named after him. In Lithuania, the same thing. There's never been anybody, no war crimes, and there's over 400, you know, known mass murderers. Some of them have since died. But, I mean, and it's not taught in the school. So these people have not claimed, along with their independence, they haven't claimed their past. They haven't just put it out there and said, we did this, like Germany said. We're going to teach it in the schools. You can't find a person walking around in Lithuania when you say, what happened in the Holocaust? They're like, what, huh, who? You know, were there Jews here? No, they were never here.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is they're paving over the graveyards. They're knocking down any buildings so they can say that there was never anyone here. So, of course, we didn't kill anyone.
Yeah, it's like the Armenian genocide or the Japanese refusal.
Yes. And then at the same time, in Ukraine especially, and this was like news to me, you know, because I walk around in the woods. You can't walk 10 feet without tripping over a mass grave in Ukraine. I think there's so many more killed than are reported, you know. So every once in a while, a mass grave opens up and skulls come floating down during a rainstorm into a town, and a kid looks and says, oh, what's this? There's bullet holes in all these skulls. So they started to teach in the schools, and I was told this by an educator in Ukraine, that the mass graves are full of Ukrainian citizens killed by the Jews during the Holocaust.
Oh, my God.
So now you've got a whole other generation of kids who've never met a Jewish person who are learning that the Jews killed the Ukrainians because everyone over there is rewriting history. And the rewriting of history is one of the most horrible occurrences in this whole thing, which is why the archive that we're making is so important to get these stories out, because once this is all, you know, it's happening in Bosnia too, they're rewriting history. You know, all the sides rewrite it to their own fashion. And unless education happens and people realize what's going on and own their own history, the world will never change. You know, it's going to get worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, the grievances and hatreds of the father will be passed on to the son and to the grandson.
And more. And, you know, you asked me before about, you know, how do the people come to grips with it. One of the hardest things to realize is, you know, you'll see a row of huts, right? And out in the countryside. And in hut one, they killed Jews. In hut two, they hid 12 Jews. In hut three, they hid Jews and they were all killed. In hut four, they murdered Jews. Now, this is same little town, all grew up together, same parish, you know, same education or non-education. So what makes one household compassionate and one household a mass murderer, you know? It's very hard to understand that, you know?
Sure.
Is it a disease? I mean, I don't know, but that's what it's like over there. You go from, it's person to person, either helped or didn't help.
Well, Zane, let me thank you for coming on the show on American Voices and salute you once again for the work you're doing. It will be important for history and certainly important for the individuals you now are touching and for all of us who are listening.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I've been speaking with Zane Busby, founder of the Survivor Mitzvah Project. You can find them online. It's survivormitzvah.org. And join us next week when we return with another episode of American Voices. Visit us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/American Voices with Senator Bill Bradley. I love reading your emails and your posts about the show. Senior producer Devorah Klar, associate producer Ian Scotto, technical director James Bilodeau.
American Voices with Senator Bill Bradley is made possible by Barrick Gold, America's largest gold producer and a force for good in the communities where we live and work.
For SiriusXM Radio, you've been listening to an American Voices special. I'm Bill Bradley.